I'm Lizzie Stern, the literary director at Playwrights Horizons, and this is an in-process interview with Will Butler, who wrote the music for Stereophonic. Will is a Grammy Award-winning musician, formerly of the band Arcade Fire. He also wrote the score for the movie Her, for which he was nominated for an Oscar, and you can now stream his latest album, Will Butler and Sister Squares. Hope you enjoy our conversation. Thank you for doing this.
Of course.
Why don't we start with you being in theater? So can you tell me about why? Like, why did you want to start working on plays? What's wrong with you?
Well, I moved to New York almost 10 years ago, and this is why you live in New York, so you can work in the theater. That's part of it. Part of it is I did a lot of high school theater,
Like what?
You know, I was Jesus in Godspell. I was El Gallo in The Fantastics. But also, I went to a very fancy boarding school, prep school. So you could just run rampant. So there was a theater workshop in the back with lumber and power tools. And we did student productions and we wrote stupid science fiction plays. There's one called Crush Door, The Loneliest Crush Bot, about a robot that's pretty lonely.
Oh.
So we did all that. And then I went to college and I went to Northwestern, which had a proper theater department. And I walked in and I was like, oh God, get me out of here. This is too professional. Like, no, this is not a profession. This is theater is you just do shit with people and it is not a profession. Though there are some lovely, amazing actors that came out of Northwestern and everything, it's great. And I like all forms of folk art, and theater as a folk art is very appealing to me, or as in, a bunch of idiots in a room trying to do a thing, which is how I've always approached music and how I've always approached rock and roll shows. It's like, here are a bunch of idiots in a room trying to do a thing. And there's something very beautiful about watching people try to do a thing, whether they succeed or fail. As long as the thing is good, you know, there's a certain bar you want it to be good, and it has to have something. So then me and David had lunch at the diner around the corner from Playwrights, and it's like, I'm doing this. It's just like in the first 30 seconds of hearing the tone of someone's voice, you're like, are you friends or not? We can do this, or we can try to do this. And so I sent him some music, none of which was perfect, but it was an offering of kind of something along the lines of what the play feels like to me. And we just kind of went from there.
So you had read the draft that he had at the time?
There was no draft. There was 1,200 loose pages.
Yeah.
So I don't think I read that. I don't think he sent that to me. He just described the play to me. Like, this is a band in the studio. I was like, okay, yeah, I mean, I'm in a band and I don't have the visceral sense of the 70s that David has. It's so primal for David, which I think ultimately worked because there was nothing for me to live up to, or there was no like weird Freudian thing I had to overcome to think about the 70s.
So you shared those initial demos?
Demos.
The right word?
Yeah,
okay.
Demos.
Initial demos with David. And then how did things evolve from there?
I mean, that was kind of it for 3 years almost.
Wow.
Because there were a lot of words to be written and edited and shaped. So David and Daniel Locken was also there on board. And they just had to make the play. It's like, this is the idea for a play. This is not a play yet. We've got 1,000 workshops to do. So 3 years later, we have a workshop. People are pretending to play musical instruments and literally making up improv songs as it's happening.
Do you know what year it was?
16, 2015?
Yeah.
And so it was starting to take shape. And then we had the first workshop where I think people sang, played the music, but the people weren't playing the songs. We did that in a theater in 2018, and then we did a big old workshop in 2019, like a 3 week, the band is the actors. So there were those kind of way stations of workshops.
Right.
Which was great for me. I mean, David was in the shit for a decade.
I mean, the way David has described the process of writing the play is basically that he lived with these characters for over a decade, observed them living their mundane, boring, ordinary lives, and then built a container around it to give it a dramatic structure. I'm curious for you to talk about the song structure and the lyrics and how that fits into the larger structure of the play and how that evolved.
Lyrically, working on this in a structural sense, you're just trying to keep the whole reality of it in your brain at the same time. Which is possible when you're working on it and living it and reading the play a lot. It'd be like Daniel, David, me, and Justin Craig, our music director,
yeah,
kind of not even trying to put any emotion in it, just reading the words, and I read through it 100 times.
Who was your favorite to play?
I can't remember. David was just like, just read it. You did high school theater, didn't you? Stop doing that.
I love it.
The first draft is just trying to emerge from that, where it's like, I am this character. What am I thinking? Mm-hmm. And I am Diana, and I'm sitting at a piano, and I am annoyed in the following ways. You kind of just try to hold the things at the same time to make the music or to make the lyrics. And, you know, it's the whole thing's a magic trick. And, you know, magic tricks take a lot of behind-the-scenes work.
Yeah, and when you say it's like a magic trick, you mean because to look effortless and to trick you and be an illusion requires so much pragmatic attention and work and effort.
I mean, when I'm making an album now in the year 2023, or, you know, for the last decade of making a record, you just end up with these vast piles of digital detritus of, oh God, that was so promising. Oh, that's such a good song. And that you have a little demo, you record something on your iPhone and it's magical, but it's not a thing. And then you try to make it in a thing and it just dies. And you're like, well, okay, well, anyway, put that in the boneyard and mm-hmm. then these things are gonna live. And then there's 1,000 versions of all these songs and it's a very contingent path through history what ends up making it onto a record. And then, oh, these things hang together and this is actually the very best song of them all, but we just never could get it right. Mm-hmm. Or the lyric was wrong or something. I don't know, it just doesn't feel right. But also, it didn't feel right 2 years into working on it, and maybe I'm a dumbass for cutting it, but it just doesn't feel right anymore because mm-hmm. it's dead to me. And that is kind of the process that David was describing, and it's kind of the process that the band is going through in Stereophonic, where they, it's not digital detritus, but they're just recording everything all the time. And that's what a big budget band would be doing in the 70s, just mountains and mountains of magnetic reels of tape. Mm-hmm. And then people in the back room slicing the tape with razors, and because that's how you edit things, is mm-hmm. literally with a razor in the back room. And so it's just magnet particles and sheafs of paper of, you know, notes on all the takes, and there's 35 takes of a song, and it's all handwritten notes on strips of masking tape, and you save all the strips of masking tape to tape to the board so mm-hmm. you can tell where the faders are and all that stuff. It's a very familiar process, mm-hmm. and it's very appealing to me to try. There is a magic you can get with 70 seconds of a song that you can't quite get with a full song.
Mm. Say more about that.
Kind of the first coherent chunk of music we hear is Diana sits at the piano and plays a song. She plays a verse and a chorus of a song, and then she's like, okay, and then you keep going. But she just plays the verse and the chorus.
Sunday morning, and light is fine. In the beating of a bird's wing, I come alive. I've been dreaming of a love song, but what good are dreams when the wind starts blowing? Nothing's forgotten, nothing's forgiven when the night comes to an end. Like the bird on the windowsill.
It kind of functions on a few levels. One is, if you're just watching the play and you're watching the magic trick that is the play, it's a release because they've just been talking. It's just these idiots talking for hours and hours. And then they finally play a little bit of a song and you're like, holy shit. And then it stops. And then she pulls herself out of it. But also, if you're listening to the music, you kind of have to build the song in your mind. You know this is the start of the song, and so the chorus hits, and you can tell the chorus hits, and your brain kind of fills in. This is just her playing the song in the room, and so your brain adds the world around it, which is amazing. But you also can't, I mean, that's a hard trick to pull for 5 minutes, but it's an easy trick to pull for 80 seconds because you can hold it in your brain. You can imagine it as this amazing record. That's the emotion you're trying to get, as of having heard this amazing record. Mm-hmm. In some sense, the goal is for people to remember having heard a thing.
Interesting. That's really interesting, because this also has to do with the sort of ephemerality of a live performance, both of a play and of a song, right? Yeah. the original version of it exists for the fleeting moment. And the only kind of real authentic experience of that is the one you have when you hear it right then and there, right?
Yeah, there's a funny thing about recorded music that I don't know that we've, I mean, maybe I just haven't read enough theory, but I don't know that we've critically caught up to what recorded music is and how it, just like there's all this culture that just disappears into the air and it's very mysterious.
Yeah.
And it's just like, if you dig up a grave from 1,000 years ago, there's a lot you can know. You can like know what they ate for dinner on the day they died because they just, whatever.
Yeah.
But there's a lot that just dissipates. But now that it's recorded, it's in the tradition of Babylonian cuneiform.
What do you mean?
It moved from cultural practice to cultural artifact. There's something about the recording process that's a little bit mysterious. That's very different than Bach writing out the music,
right,
which is also cuneiform, but
right,
it's a different thing. So like in the play, there's a very specific technological component that
right,
is also, in some sense, is period, but is also 2023 and computer-based and all those things, but it's also like trying to make it feel like it sounds like the 70s. Not trying to make it sound like the 70s, but trying to make it feel like it sounds
like the
70s.
Feel like it sounds like the 70s.
So there's very specific like British Navy drills of getting stuff down, but also, yeah, technological challenges, which we're all, everyone in back of house is doing it.
Yeah.
My experience on this play is that editing process has brought more dimensions to the music and to the lyrics. Sometimes 1,000 editors will flatten something and sometimes they'll make it a little more 3D. And I think trying to think about it from different perspectives, trying to think what Daniel is thinking, trying to think what David's thinking, trying to think what people that don't care about music are thinking, trying to think about what people that lived through the 70s are thinking, doing all that worrying in a casual way.
Casual worrying, yeah.
Because there's other people that are not casually worrying about stuff, so it's okay. And yeah, trying to set the music to the actors, but also leaving space for the actors to make it their own. Mm. It is becomes the play where you're like, let's try it again a little bit faster. Oh no, that's too fast. And then, no, let's try it slower. Try a different drum beat. Like, try taking the snare out. And you're just like, like I'm verbatim doing a fucking scene from the play.
I know. It's
the snare sounds a little crazy. Like,
dizzyingly meta. Yeah. And it's interesting to have these characters, the two producers in the play, Grover and Charlie. David was telling me how those characters came pretty late for him. He was saying there was a day where, maybe it was you who said it, like, you know, there'd probably be some guys there who were making it, who are stand-ins a little bit for the audience on some level, but stand-ins for you guys too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to talk about fame, and specifically the kind of insane fame that was happening for musicians in the 60s, 70s, and the rock god, and the idea of them being a god to a mythic level.
Yeah,
whatever that sparks for you, I'm curious to hear about.
Like, it wasn't physically possible, the amount of fame that you could have in the 70s. You know, it was a product of television and airline travel and jet engine developments. It's very much something new under the sun. I remember David talking about this era and being like, this is how we got Reagan.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's something about just the money, and you get a little protective of your money, and you're like, but I earned this even as an artist. And the Rolling Stones doing tax dodges. There's something that, yeah, that produces Reaganism.
It's so interesting. Totally. And I think that the cult of personality, the way that people become obsessed with and idolize a single individual person.
Yeah.
And putting individualism ahead of other things and locating it in artists.
I can dimly imagine how much it'll mess you up. Even just having someone look at you all day, every day, will start to melt your brain. You know, you're also very grateful to people, mm-hmm. but you start, I mean, I never did drugs or anything, so it's I'm just guessing here, but like you definitely, as you use drugs to deal with things, you get less capacity to deal with it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, there's like the bag of cocaine omnipresent on the stage is part of it. There's a Scorsese documentary, The Last Waltz, which is the last concert by the band. And self-consciously, like, this is our last show. And guests come on, and Bob Dylan plays, and Neil Young plays, and Neil Diamond plays. But everyone is so wasted. It's really grim. Like, in some sense, you can watch it and be like, Jesus Christ, this is miserable. It's horrifying. And then another way, you're like, great tunes. Like, this is great. Yeah. But Neil Young on stage, you're like, dude, you need to chill out. Something, you don't look good, man. Yeah. But it's beautiful, but also.
You're not well. Yeah. I'm curious to hear you talk about that thematic thread too of like in Stereophonic, these are people who are creating a piece of art that will immortalize them, that will really cement their fame and longevity beyond their human lifespan. And they're killing themselves for it. They're dying for the cause.
Yeah. I think fame and money, and they get a big budget to make this record.
Yeah. But
it's just one of those extreme materials tests where you just don't know what'll happen when you heat a bar of iron beyond the steel stage. What happens then? Mm. Oh, it turns into a crazy magnet. Oh, it turns into a nuclear bomb. Like, oh, it's extreme human thing.
I feel like there's a version of that that's true for everybody in terms of how we value work and productivity, and that it's something we're all conditioned to prioritize. And especially for artists, there's supposed to be something kind of self-actualizing about the production of work, and it's supposed to give something back to you. And on some level it does, but on some level it's not true that the more that you put in, the more you get back.
And in my experience, there's not a larger decision to kill yourself for your art. It's very much day to day. How am I going to move the next 10 feet? It's very much steps along a path.
Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna go this way. This is what I gotta do. 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 This is what I gotta do.
Yes. Just yeah.
Like, okay. Well, shit. And it feels very true in the play. Like by the end, they're pretty blasted.
Yeah.
But it is a very good record.
This was awesome. Well, thank you. I'm really, really excited about this one.